Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. As we approach the first anniversary on Monday of the Hamas attacks on Israel that started the still widening regional war, Israel is pressing ahead with its offensives on two fronts. We'll come to Lebanon shortly and we'll hear more about the anniversary later in the programme. First to Gaza, where Israel responded to the 7th of October attacks by Hamas with an intense bombing campaign followed by a ground invasion. More than 42,000 people have been killed in Gaza since then. That's according to the territory's Hamas-run health ministry. With Israel having begun its ground invasion of southern Lebanon last week, the world's attention has been drawn away from Gaza, but the Israeli army now says it's encircled the town of Jabalia and struck dozens of targets after detecting efforts by Hamas to rebuild its capabilities there. The Gaza authorities say 26 people were killed overnight when Israel bombed a mosque and a school in central Gaza. Ahmed Al-Fleet does the call to prayer at the mosque.
At 2:30 this morning, the mosque was bombed and I was informed about it. I found displaced people under the rubble, covered in debris. 20 of them were killed and another 20 were injured.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem is John Donison. He told me more about what had happened first in Gaza today.
Such has been the pace of events in the region over the past 2 weeks. The war in Gaza has really dropped from the headlines, but it's not over. Fighting is ongoing and people are dying there on a daily basis. So overnight, Israel bombed a mosque and a school housing displaced people where it said Hamas was operating. In Jabalia, in the north of the Gaza Strip, people were once again fleeing their homes after Israel surrounded an area there, saying that Hamas fighters were regrouping. So there's a lot going on. I just looked at the UN figures for the past week. They rely on Gaza's Ministry of Health, which of course is run by Hamas, but the UN says those figures are reliable. And over 200 people have been killed in Gaza just in the past week.
The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been on the Lebanese border with Israeli troops, hasn't he?
He has. He went up there earlier today. Of course, we had sirens in northern Israel again today, and Israel's missile defence system shooting down Hezbollah rockets. Hezbollah are continuing to fire. Mr. Netanyahu addressed the troops there. He said a year ago, referring to October the 7th, Israel had suffered a terrible blow. But he said Israel was now changing reality across the borders, he put it, and he vowed that his country would win.
And Mr. Netanyahu has been in defensive mode on the telephone with the French president, hasn't he?
President Macron yesterday said that France would stop sending arms to Israel, would stop its arms exports. I don't think it has a particularly significant amount of arms that it sends to Israel, but President Macron called on other countries to do so. One suspects he was addressing that at America, who is the primary arms supplier to Israel. It gives billions of dollars in military aid every year. Mr. Netanyahu was not impressed. He said Mr. Macron's comments were a disgrace, and he said, shame on you.
What is the atmosphere like in Israel, would you say, the day before this anniversary is marked of the 7th of October attacks?
Well, look, October the 7th on Monday is obviously a very important day for Israelis, but a year ago, the country was very much united in their revulsion at what Hamas had done. Well, 12 months on, the country is divided. The public are divided, the politicians, even the military, about the strategy in Gaza. Because, of course, we still have scores of hostages being held there. Last night I went to another mass protest in Jerusalem, organised by the supporters of families of the hostages, and they were furious at the government of Prime Minister Netanyahu, as they have been now for months. They say he is putting his own personal political ambitions ahead of getting those hostages out.
John Donison reporting from Jerusalem to Lebanon now, where there's an Israeli military operation along Israel's northern border, and where overnight last night some of the most widespread aerial attacks so far took place on parts of the capital, Beirut. Jumana Haddad is a prominent Lebanese poet, writer and translator. She's at home in Beirut, and I asked her to describe her experience of the bombings.
Yesterday night was the most violent night so far in Beirut. Obviously, we can't sleep with all the explosions around us and with fear inside of us, because our mental state, I mean, what can I say? We're like living on the brink of life. We are just waiting to die. It's not life. We're not living. It's like we wake up in the middle of the night to the cold voice of a soldier telling us to evacuate immediately because the Israeli planes will strike. We can't sleep, and we feel lucky compared to all those who have lost their lives, lost their loved ones, lost their homes. I mean, our families and our lives and our futures are held hostage. There are more than a million displaced people now, not to mention that more than 2,000 people who have been killed in less than 2 weeks and 10,000 who have been injured. But there are whole families sleeping on the streets because their homes have been bombed or because they could be bombed any second. And they can't count on anyone because, you know, we have a failed state in Lebanon. The institutions have collapsed. We have been struggling for the past 5 years, crisis after crisis, trauma after trauma, an endless cycle of death and despair. And I'm tired to hear about the Phoenix metaphor about Lebanon. Enough with that. I'm tired of hearing that we are a resilient people. We do not want to be resilient. We just deserve to live.
Filippo Grandi has recently arrived in Beirut. He is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And he spoke to me earlier today from a school in the city that's become a shelter for about 1,200 displaced people.
What is needed is really for the international community to exercise even more pressure on all parties involved so that they go back to the negotiating table. May I say, and this is beyond my mandate, which is humanitarian, but a ceasefire in itself is important and urgent, but then there has to be political processes that cement and make the ceasefire sustainable.
And how dismaying is it for you as a representative of the United Nations that the UN seems to have almost no voice here, certainly not with the Israeli government?
The United Nations political mechanism, Security Council and otherwise, have been pretty powerless in addressing this crisis. I was in New York a few days ago at the General Assembly. I came back disheartened by the paralysis of political action. And I keep warning everybody, humanitarian agencies will do what they can, as we're doing here. But we are also at the maximum stretching point. We can't go on like this. We need peacemaking to be restored, or else catastrophes will continue to occur.
Israel's line at the moment seems to be that if Hezbollah stops shelling northern Israel and if they retreat their forces back to north of the Litani River, then the fighting will stop. Do you see hope there?
I hope that Israel and Hezbollah both will understand and accept that the only way forward is to silence the guns. And then you described exactly what the famous Security Council Resolution 1701 stipulates, which needs to be implemented. I feel very, very worried. Our capacities are also limited, and we have so many theaters of war. So I am worried that we're reaching breaking point here.
That was Filippo Grandi, who is United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, who is speaking to me from Beirut. I'm joined now from Tel Aviv by Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, who is a spokesperson for the Israeli Defence Forces. Welcome, Mr. Lerner. There are fresh evacuation orders for southern Beirut tonight. Who are you targeting there?
Good evening. If you've seen those evacuation orders, they're for four specific locations. Four locations we suspect and understand and know that are being used by Hezbollah either to operate, conduct their operations, or to use as weapon storage positions or intelligence capabilities. These are the types of things that we are targeting. So it's not all of Beirut. It's four specific locations, as we've been conducting over the last 10 days.
And is it inevitable that civilians will be collateral? There are claims today from Beirut that earlier evacuation orders were given by Israel with 10 minutes notice in the middle of the night. There was no real opportunity to escape.
So I think what we've seen throughout the course of the last 2 weeks is people are listening to our evacuation orders. We are seeing people move from locations we're telling them specifically to go from. And I would actually say that most of the areas that we've instructed people to evacuate from are actually very, very low, limited population at this time, because they know they are in the heartland of Hezbollah's locations. So people are understanding that where Hezbollah has positioned their rockets, their missiles, their command and control positions, their communications capabilities, their intelligence capabilities is next door. And so they're taking responsibility from their lives. And when we're issuing these warnings, they are listening to us and they are moving.
You heard briefly from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, there in a news conference today. He said there had been many instances of, quote, violations of international humanitarian law in the way that Israeli airstrikes on Lebanon were conducted, that they destroyed or damaged civilian infrastructure, they killed civilians, and they had impacted humanitarian operations. What do you say to that?
You know, I would argue that the IDF conducts its operations within the realm of laws of armed conflict. Our operations are conducted with accompanying legal advisors and those that are responsible for applying the law and implementation of operations. Unfortunately, we're up against a terrorist organization, a terrorist army that has no regard for any of those laws that you and I both respect. So I would say, yeah, there is a huge challenge when conducting this type of war against this type of enemy. But we are, you know, watch ourselves extremely carefully. We take into consideration the laws of armed conflict, which include the laws of and the issues of proportionality, precaution, and distinction. And that is precisely when we call for people to evacuate. That's just one illustration of how that comes to be.
And just briefly,
also in how we plan to conduct those attacks. Yes.
A year on from the October the 7th attacks, the IDF is still fighting Hamas in Gaza, as is evidenced today. Does that mean that so far Israel has failed in its aim to defeat Hamas and free the hostages? 101 remain.
I think so. Obviously, though, we're still pained by the 101 hostages that remain in the clutches of Hamas. Hamas, when they decided to launch their invasion into Israel on last year, made a strategic decision. And there are consequences for that. And Israel determined two core outcomes of this war.
Peter Lerner, we have to end it there. Many thanks. Spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Forces. Coming up on the programme, we'll hear about the groundbreaking London nightclub of the 1980s, Taboo, whose cocktail of fashion, art and music attracted the stars of the day.
It was rumoured that Mick Jagger went there one night. Loads of pop stars, George Michael, all the fashion designers, Boy George, all the people from the magazines.
The headlines this hour: Israel is on a state of high alert ahead of the first anniversary of the Hamas attacks. But despite the killing of a border police officer and the continued offensive against Hamas and Hezbollah, Israelis have been visiting the sites where so many were massacred. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour live from the BBC World Service. Now, what is the end game of the war that Israel is prosecuting in Lebanon? Can they eliminate Hezbollah? And what might be the next stage of the Israeli campaign? I'm joined live from Beirut by David Wood, who's a senior analyst for Lebanon at the conflict resolution organisation, the International Crisis Group. David, welcome. Is what's happening in Lebanon, do you think, winnable for Israel?
So I think that it's very clear what Israel's war objective is with its expanded campaign in Lebanon, and that is its official war aim of returning displaced residents of northern Israel safely to their homes. But what's not so clear is, as you point out, what is the end game in terms of how will it be achieved strategically? So we've seen a massive expansion of Israel's aerial bombardments in the southern suburbs of Beirut, but also in the Bekaa Valley and southern Lebanon, amongst other locations. And we've seen the start of these limited ground incursions, as the IDF describes it. However, it's not entirely clear how Israel plans to turn these military operations into a lasting security arrangement that would allow displaced residents to return to the north of Israel.
We do know, don't we, that many perhaps senior members of Hezbollah have been killed. Who is doing the fighting at the moment? And can Hezbollah actually survive after this war?
So without a doubt, it's clear that Israel has severely decimated Hezbollah's military leadership. And this obviously has consequences for the organization. Undoubtedly, it's been weakened, especially in recent weeks. On the other hand, we have seen that Hezbollah has been able to maintain rocket fire into northern Israel throughout. And it has also been able to violently resist incursions by Israel across the border. So while it's undoubtedly true that Hezbollah has been weakened, it has not been cowed. And this will present challenges for Israel moving forward, particularly if it expands its ground operations. Now, it's clear that as Hezbollah has no potential to stop Israel's dominance of Lebanese airspace and its aerial bombardments, but it is showing greater signs of success against a ground invasion, which is more suited to an organization experienced in insurgency warfare like Hezbollah.
Do civilians who rightly fear for their lives amid all this think that Israel is waging a war on them or on Hezbollah? In which case, do they blame Hezbollah?
I think that regardless of whether we're talking about supporters of Hezbollah or opponents of Hezbollah, almost all Lebanese are united in their fears that this is becoming less a war between Israel and Hezbollah and a war that Israel is waging against Lebanon. We're seeing that while Israel is mainly directing its aerial strikes into civilian areas associated with Hezbollah, there have also been strikes in different parts of the country, which you might not have expected. Which is increasing fears of people in Lebanon, whether or not they support Hezbollah, that this war could expand into a truly full-scale war, including the targeting of civilian infrastructure, and that this could have disastrous consequences for all Lebanese, not just supporters of Hezbollah.
Could the main strategy simply be to stop Hezbollah firing rockets into northern Israel? Is that achievable, and how soon?
So the challenge here is that there are no clear military options that would lead to that. So we see that evidently Israel has concluded that aerial bombardments alone will not be enough to destroy Hezbollah or, short of that, to eliminate the threat of rocket fire into northern Israel. So we see the start of this ground incursions. Now, while they are apparently limited targeted raids for now, it is imaginable that Israel might conclude after weeks, perhaps, that it needs to establish some kind of security zone with permanent boots on the ground to ensure that Hezbollah fighters can't approach the border.
Okay.
But then what happens if Israel's military command decides that it needs to move into other areas of Lebanon outside the south, so for example, the Bekaa Valley, perhaps even the southern suburbs of Beirut, and eliminate Hezbollah infrastructure from the ground there? And then also what happens if Israeli soldiers come under fire from Hezbollah? Do they pursue the attackers and therefore push further into Lebanon? So any and all of these scenarios could drag Israel into a protracted war which could go on for months, if not years.
Many thanks.
And could increasingly...
Sorry, David Wood from the International Crisis Group in Lebanon. To Tunisia now, on the African Mediterranean coast. Voters have today been electing a president there. Opposition activists called for a boycott. The incumbent, President Kais Saied, is widely expected to win, having cracked down on potential rivals, putting nearly all of them in prison. Monica Marks has been observing voting. She's assistant professor of Middle Eastern Studies at New York University in Abu Dhabi. She gave me her analysis of Tunisia under its current leader.
Kais Saied styled himself as an anti-corruption candidate, but he's erased Tunisia's formerly independent anti-corruption commission. He's erased all forms of independent election observation in Tunisia. He has obstructed journalist freedom to cover politics in the country. So there is an absence of transparency in a way that there never was under Tunisia's democratic decade between 2011 and 2021 before Kais Saied made his coup.
What's happened to those who opposed him?
Saied's opponents have variously been jailed on bogus charges, hauled in front of anti-terrorism commissions, also on bogus charges, obviously, their crimes being nothing more than trying to preserve and restore Tunisia's democracy or criticizing Saied or even being perceived to criticize the direction of the country obliquely or directly. Simply declaring one's candidacy to run in the presidential election this summer was arguably the most dangerous thing that you could do here in Tunisia. Many of the smartest intellectuals and bravest pro-democracy activists in the country have left, often to France, but to countries really around the globe. Just a few days ago, one of the candidates was sentenced to 12 years in prison for having allegedly falsified signatures on his voter application to run in the election.
Has the president managed to suppress voter enthusiasm as well?
Oh, absolutely. Enthusiasm to turn out in today's election here in Tunisia is a fraction of what it was in presidential elections held during Tunisia's democratic decade in 2014 and in 2019. So a lot of Tunisians feel like today's election is a pointless exercise in authoritarian posturing. They feel like it's a masquerade. You hear that word all the time used to describe the election. Some people in the opposition understand that it's rigged, but they want to make his job as difficult as possible. And they also are desperate to express themselves, so have gone out to vote today for other candidates on the ballot regardless. There's also a lot of Tunisians who weren't even aware that there were other candidates on the ballot.
It sounds like it's been a fairly grim journey for a country that was the birthplace of the Arab Spring. Away from and not towards democracy, are lives in Tunisia still as hard, high unemployment, etc.?
It's been an absolute tragedy to watch the Arab world's first and only real, free, organically created democracy fall into such doldrums. It feels like Tunisians have lost a kind of collective self-confidence about what they can actually achieve together after making that 2011 revolution that inspired so many people around the region. The economy today is worse than it has been since I started coming to Tunisia 17 years ago. People are really struggling to make ends meet. Saied seems to have really no plan to fix that. He seems to be a paranoid, ineffective authoritarian. And a lot of Tunisians are really perplexed by how he's managed to hold on to autocratic powers as long as he has. So it almost feels like watching a country be gradually lobotomized.
Monica Marks, academic and specialist in Tunisia. This is the BBC World Service live from London. NewsHour.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
In a moment, we'll return to our top story, the fighting in the Middle East. But first, it's been a year since Hollywood's writers ended their months-long strike and went back to work. Many expected a return to the booming days of the streaming wars once the strikes ended. But those days are over and film and TV workers are being hit hard. The BBC's Regan Morris reports from Hollywood.
Film production is actually struggling. The hardest hit Hollywood.
I mean, our biggest industry here is being hit pretty hard.
But for many in the industry, business still has not bounced back.
This is not the happy ending Hollywood hoped for. The lights and cameras are ready to roll, but there's been very little action since the strikes ended.
It's been crushing. It's been devastating.
Actor and aerial cinematographer Michael Fortin was at the heart of Hollywood's golden age of streaming, turning his drone hobby into a profitable business. And for a decade, he was flying high above film sets, creating previously unthinkable, sleek aerial shots for movies and TV shows.
2 years ago, when after the pandemic, things were just booming. I just worked today for the first time since April. I've only worked 22 days since the strike ended. So it's been, you know, incredibly difficult. I should say, I mean, my wife is an actress. My 9-year-old son is an actor. I work in the industry both behind and in front of the camera. And so our existence has been Hollywood. It's what we know.
What they don't know is if they can continue to make a living in Hollywood. But production is down around the globe, largely because companies haven't figured out how to make streaming profitable.
The air has come out of the content bubble.
Matthew Bellany is the founder of Puck News, which covers the business of Hollywood.
There was a run-up in the level of film and television production over 10 to 12 years. All of these traditional Hollywood players launched streaming services and were competing with the upstart streamers, and it caused an overheating of the content market.
Not all streaming services are expected to survive, and more consolidation and layoffs are likely. Screen Actors Guild chief negotiator Duncan Crabtree Ireland says Hollywood is known for reinventing itself.
So much of the strikes, the writer strike and the actor strike, was about AI protections, and now we've seen some sort of legislative protections in, and I just keep interviewing people who are losing their homes, getting evicted. I mean, it's rough out there. Do you ever think, was it worth it?
I think in this case, it clearly was not only worth it, but absolutely necessary. Because if we hadn't fought for the protections that we achieved last year, the threat to our members and, frankly, to others working in the industry would be far greater. What makes these companies special, what gives them their unique ability to create value, is their relationship with creative talent.
And until that creative talent gets back to work, there'll be less for the rest of us to binge watch.
The BBC's Regan Morris reporting there from Hollywood. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. So Monday is the first anniversary of the October the 7th attacks by Hamas in Israel, which killed about 1,200 people and during which 251 others were taken hostage. One of the communities that was attacked was Be'eri Kibbutz, where 101 people were killed, with gunmen from Hamas and other armed groups rampaging through its tree-lined streets, burning homes and shooting people indiscriminately. Another 30 residents and their family members were taken to Gaza as hostages. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, joins us now from Be'eri. And Lise, what's been happening today there?
Well, it's just coming up to midnight, Paul, and so we're just a very short time away from the beginning of October the 7th. And I have to say, it's absolutely chilling to be here, to think that people living in this community, and from where I'm standing, I can see houses in ruins, just charred remains of what's left after Hamas went on their murderous rampage. But this time, a year ago, people were just perhaps getting to bed, and just down the road was the Nova Music Festival, where thousands of Israelis and people who'd come from around the world to dance the night away at the Nova rave. And now it's The forest of Rheims is now a forest of flags and flowers and photographs of the smiling faces of the 400 people who were killed in the morning when a celebration turned into a slaughter and 33 people were taken hostage there. So these are like ghost communities. People have not returned. Here in Barrie, a few people are coming back to try to see what it's like here. And they've started bringing back their loved ones in the sense of that they're burying them here now because they had to bury them elsewhere in that terrible aftermath of October the 7th.
And at the Neir Oz kibbutz earlier, you talked, didn't you, to a woman who lost many members of her family a year ago?
It's still an open wound. The pain is still raw. The tears are still flowing. And we began the day here in Neir Oz. It used to be a beautiful little community of 400 frangipani flowering trees. And many peace activists lived in Neir Oz, about a mile from the border. But they lost a quarter of their population. More than about 117 were either killed or kidnapped. And I met the Renee Butler, who lost six members of her family, including her mother, Carol, 72 years old, and her brother and his wife and their three children, two six-year-old girls and a little boy, Omar, who's 2 years old. And we stood in front of their house, which was just a charred shell.
So this was their home. This is where their bicycles would park. Everything of childhood was over here. It was obvious that you're entering a house of children. It was a carnage in my family. I never thought to the day I would die, I would ever know anyone who was murdered or someone whose family member was murdered. And we had people intentionally murdering people. I cannot imagine what went through the three kids while their parents were bleeding to death. And they were suffocating or trying to wake their parents or whatever. I don't know what was happening with my mom with terrorists on her that morning.
There was a moment of hope. You received a message from Jonathan, whose home we see behind us.
That I was just telling them there's rockets in Tel Aviv, so I'm assuming there's rockets there as well. And he said, yes, stay safe. That was his message. Later, we received messages from the kibbutz about people being just asking for help. They're not giving up. They're burning the houses. They have burned my family, their house. The moment they couldn't enter the safe room, they decided to burn them. Messages from the kibbutz were heartbreaking. I don't think anyone imagined that something like this can happen at the 21st century, of people intentionally targeting you to kill you, to murder you, not to kill you.
And anger mixed in with grief that so many calls for help and help didn't come?
I'm mainly sad, deeply, deeply sad, deeply worried about the hostages still in Gaza, 101 Israelis, 29 from Neir Oz that we know personally. And I'm very mad of the language laundering of so-called conflict, when the only conflict is they want to murder Jews and we choose life and living. It upsets me that so many people are confused or duped by masters of deceit. If Israel was left alone, we'd be mostly pacifists here. Nobody would do anything to anyone. We're good neighbors. We're good people. The quality of people here is insurmountable. My brother was pure, friendly, clean, such a good father, such a good husband, such a good brother, such a good son, such a good friend. So many people came to me and said, Johnny was my best friend. Many, many guy friends. They have no idea what they've done. the sanctity of life. They don't know how many worlds they've taken. My sister-in-law, too, she was out of this world.
You mentioned the hostages, around 100 still. Gaza, not far from where we're staying. They've been taking to the streets, calling for a ceasefire. Can you see an end to this war?
An end to the war? I don't know. I think it's something about engineering consciousness, and that's where the war is happening, and Israel wasn't really participating. You don't want to go deep down into the hatred sort of living and argue that. I think that's a real war. If anyone has a good idea for us, what we can do to survive, this is an existential situation for us, then please, I'd love to hear your thoughts. How do we stop this from happening, from people who swear to keep on doing this?
Rane Butler talking to you earlier there, Lees. How will this anniversary be marked tomorrow, Monday, then?
Well, Israel is on a state of alert because they worry that there will be attacks tomorrow that will mar the ceremonies. I have to say that during the day, the stillness of this area, you could hear the birds during that interview with Renee, and I can hear the crickets now here. There was the heavy booms of loud booms of artillery as Israeli big guns were firing into Gaza. The war goes on there, devastating war. But tomorrow in the minds of Israelis will be a moment to grieve. Each of these communities here in Berry, where I am now, in Nir Oz, and the site of the Nova Music Festival, they will all have their own ceremonies tomorrow to grieve together. And then there will be an official ceremony in Tel Aviv in the afternoon, where there'll be more Israeli officials on that one. But I think whether people attend a ceremony or whether they just sit quietly at home, everyone's thoughts will be on this day, October the 7th, seared in memory, a day Israelis say changed them forever. And across the region, they'll remember this day too, but in Lebanon, they've been under intense Israeli bombardment. As I mentioned, the war in Gaza goes on. And Israelis are also looking at the skies, because there's also the expectation that at some point soon, Israel will retaliate for Iran's barrage of nearly 200 ballistic missiles fired here, at a retaliatory strike from Iran, and then Iran will retaliate again. So 1 year on, there's a war that just gets worse.
Lees Doucette in southern Israel, thank you. A Russian opposition activist has been killed fighting for Ukraine against his home country. Ildar Dadin was part of a unit of Russian soldiers under the command of the Ukrainian army. Here he is explaining why he wanted to fight with Ukraine.
I think that the only way of resisting Russia's crimes is through armed resistance. And that's the main reason why I am here. Because I am against violence. I am against killing, against violence, against rape, against any evil. That's why now I have taken up arms to oppose the killings carried out by Russia, because I don't want to be an accomplice to this.
Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford, who's in Kyiv, has been telling me more about him.
Most recently, he was a volunteer fighter in Ukraine, fighting on the side of Kyiv and trying to defeat Vladimir Putin. But prior to that, he had been a peaceful opposition activist inside Russia, who became pretty well known, certainly in opposition circles and actually beyond, about a decade ago, when he was jailed for 2.5 years for staging repeated peaceful pickets, one-person pickets against Vladimir Putin, against political repression. And he was locked up for that in what was seen as a real escalation of political repression and the suppression of dissent in Russia. And that case then got more focus, more attention, because he was then tortured very brutally in prison. And that information came to light. In fact, I spoke to him about that after he was released from jail. And he gave a very graphic description of his treatment, physical brutality, but also the threat of rape. And he said he found it almost intolerable.
He was an unlikely soldier, wasn't he?
He was. He actually chose the call sign Gandhi because he describes himself as a pacifist. But he chose to take up arms and to join the war in Ukraine on the side of Ukraine, because I spoke to him actually quite a lot back in March and April this year, and he described his motivation and why he had taken that very difficult choice. And for him, it was absolutely a matter of conscience. He felt that he couldn't stay doing nothing on the sidelines in peace with his conscience, as he described it, whilst his own country was committing what he described very clearly as crimes and atrocities against Ukraine. He said that Russia was killing and raping and looting in Ukraine, and he had to stop that. And in fact, you know, he talked about feeling a sense of guilt that he had failed to stop Russia under Vladimir Putin before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, because he felt that Russians as a whole should have done better, essentially, in terms of their peaceful protest and stopped it getting as far as an all-out war on Russia's neighbour. So he was a man of very deep principles and very deep conscience.
What is known about how he died?
For the moment, not a huge amount. Legion, the battalion that he was most recently fighting within, has said that they won't comment whilst what they describe as an ongoing military operation.
Sarah Rainsford, our Eastern Europe correspondent, reporting there from Kyiv. You're with the BBC World Service live from London. This is NewsHour. Here's a reminder of our top story this hour. Israel is on a state of high alert ahead of the first anniversary of the Hamas attacks. Meanwhile, the Israeli army has again ordered residents of areas of southern Beirut to leave their homes. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces, told NewsHour the local population was heeding the warnings.
People are understanding that where Hezbollah has positioned their rockets, their missiles, their command and control positions, their communications capabilities, their intelligence capabilities is next door. And so they're taking responsibility from their lives. And when we're issuing these warnings, they are listening to us and they are moving.
One other headline: about a quarter of eligible voters cast their ballots in the much criticized presidential election today in Tunisia. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour, live from the BBC. The Prime Minister of the Caribbean nation of Haiti has this weekend been on an international tour, asking for more overseas help with his country's security. It follows a massacre by gangs in rural Haiti, which has spread terror and raised fresh doubts about whether the authorities can establish stability in the face of ongoing violence and looting. The Prime Minister has visited the United Arab Emirates and Kenya, which has already provided Haiti with a peacekeeping force. We can speak live now to Harold Isaac, who's an independent journalist in Port-au-Prince, which is the Haitian capital. Welcome, Harold. Tell us more, if you can, first about what happened on Thursday.
Well, Thursday was a very a dark day here in Haiti, where a brutal attack happened in the early hours of the morning, around 3 to 4 in the morning, where a gang attacked the town of Ponsonde and waged terror and killed over 70 people in the area.
And it's reported police didn't come to the scene quickly. Were they outnumbered?
Well, seemingly, yes. They were outnumbered, but they did not also venture out to offer any sort of resistance in the face of such a gruesome scene, where essentially gangs walked from house to house and killing a lot of people, including infants, and shooting them in the head.
Am I right in thinking that the situation in the capital and its environs is calmer following interventions by the new government? But this is a rural outbreak of violence, and that changes the picture somewhat.
Well, since the arrival of the Kenyan police officers, roughly 400 of them now in the capital during the summer, it has shifted kind of the narrative of the gangs in the metropolitan area. Initially, many fled the metropolitan area of Port-au-Prince into the regions. And what we're seeing is some sort, really, of that expansion into the regions.
So tell us more about Prime Minister Gary Conille's visit to Kenya and the UAE this weekend. What exactly is he asking for?
Well, it seems that this trip was already scheduled when that drama happened. But essentially, before leaving yesterday, he said he was going to go get more help. Although the Haitian government, since October of 2022, with former Prime Minister Ariel Henry, had formally requested from the international community to have a support force to help the Haitian National Police and the army to deal with the gang violence here in Haiti.
What next for Haiti, do you think? It's already facing a humanitarian and food-related crisis on top of the security issues we've talked about.
It's complicated. The country hasn't had elections in nearly 10 years. And part of the mission of the current transitional government is to deliver on security and elections by February of 2026. But as it stands right now, this looks like a really unrealistic prospect for many observers and the general population here. They're not getting any security. The capital, Port-au-Prince, is under 80% gang control, some sort of gang control. And about half of the population is facing famine-like conditions as it stands right now.
Many thanks. That's Harold Isaac, who's an independent journalist in the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. Now, as we approach the end of the programme, we're going to take a break from the news of the day to go back to the London of the 1980s, when a nightclub became home to a groundbreaking cocktail of fashion, art and music. An exhibition called Fashion Renegades of 80s London opened on Friday at the Fashion and Textile Museum here in the British capital. It centres on Taboo, a club opened by designer and performance artist Lee Bowery in 1985. Now, Sue Tilly worked in this club and she was a friend and muse to Lee Bowery and, like him, the subject of a painting by the artist Lucian Freud. She told my colleague Julian Warwicker about how she and Lee Bowery first met.
I was going out a bit, you know, I knew a few people in London, and then I met Lee. He wasn't Lee Bowery as such when I met him. He was just a young boy on the club scene. He hadn't turned himself into the sort of icon that he became.
How would you describe his personality?
Bizarre. No, sometimes it was really down-to-earth, normal person. At the same time, full of fantastic ideas. You know, his brain was always going and ticking over, thinking about new things to do.
He opened, didn't he, the Taboo nightclub?
Well, you know, we went to clubs all the time, so the next stage really is for him to run a club. In those days, you could just hire a club for a night, and loads of people just open clubs. And then somebody asked him, a man called Tony Gordon, asked him to do it with him. But, of course, Lee took over and was the boss here.
I like the dress code. The quote is, dress as though your life depends on it or don't bother.
I think some people did get turned away.
And by then, was that sort of iconic element to his personality emerging for you? And how did you begin to see that happen?
He invented this fashion with blue faces and everything. And first of all, he dressed his flatmate in it, Trojan. But when he saw how much attention that Trojan got, he thought, right, I'm doing it as well. That sort of day when he invented that look, it kind of changed him and who he was, because he looked different to everyone else when he went out. So everyone was kind of looking up to him and going, what's he wearing this week?
What of his influence on fashion sort of in a longer lasting way? Because here we are talking because we have the opening of this exhibition in London.
When he started working for Lucian Freud, because he was a model for Lucian, he becomes even more aware of his body because he's with his naked body a lot of the time. A lot of the outfits show changing of the body shape and in distorting his actual flesh.
Were there particular bits of it that stood out for you, particular favourite?
There's a model of me that I was very keen to see. It wasn't busty enough. They couldn't make the model busty enough, but still.
At its height, I mean, what were some of the big names who used to go to Taboo? Oh,
it was rumoured that Mick Jagger went there one night. Loads of pop stars, George Michael.
Obviously, Lee, sadly, is no longer with us. What do you think he would make of what is now being done about him?
I think he'd be absolutely thrilled because there's a big exhibition at the Tate Gallery.
I was about to say Tate Modern February. Next year, isn't it? A much,
yeah,
much bigger one.
Yeah. I wrote a book about Lee 27 years ago and that's being republished, ready for the Tate. Shame he's not here to see it, but
It's the next best thing.
Exactly.
Sue Tilley, a friend of Lee Bowery, whose legendary nightclub Taboo is the centre of a new exhibition here in London. And that brings to a close this edition of NewsHour for a Sunday evening, UK time. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye for now.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
One of his HR team approached me and said, the chairman would like you to work in his office.
It was pretty quick that my gut instinct started to go, this is not right.
The only thing that he was interested in was touching my body.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.